Okay? So I'm going to talk about how a sovereign currency works. I'll tell you what a sovereign currency is in a bit, but I'm thinking about the kinds of currencies we have in the United States, Canada, Australia, Turkey, every country in Europe before they joined the euro. Let's start with a quiz. I don't know how many quizzes or exams you've had so far, but we should start off now. Take out a piece of paper. It's going to be true, false. Don't look at anyone else's paper. There aren't any trick questions. There actually is a true or false to every question I'm going to ask you. And think the questions are all description, not the way we would like things to be, okay, just the way things actually are, okay? True or false? Question one, just like a household, the government has to finance its spending. Write down true or false. No, write it down. Write it down. Okay, two, the role of taxes is to provide finance for government spending. True or false? There's a correct answer. Nope, doesn't depend. True or false? The role of taxes is to provide finance for government spending. True or false? The federal government borrows money from the private sector to finance the budget deficit, which allows it to avoid the inflationary effects of printing money. Question four. It doesn't matter, we're talking about sovereign currencies. Any country with a sovereign currency. Pressure off interest rates because more funds are then available for private sector investment projects. So budget surpluses take pressures off interest rates. Question five. Persistent budget deficits will burden future generations with inflation and higher taxes. Hold on. Question six. Running budget surpluses now will help build up the funds necessary to cope with the demands of the aging population will place on health and personal care services in the future. True or false? Okay, count up your scores. All questions are false. Okay. I would expect at least two people here got them all right. But anyway, so if you got zero correct, the Obama administration's ready for you. Get zero or one, you can run for office probably in any country in the world, and so on. If you got six, then you probably don't need the presentation. You already know. Then you'll support deficits. Okay. So what I do when I try to formulate what I'm calling the modern money approach is to combine a variety of heterodox approaches, starting with the approaches of Marx, Keynes, Veblen, that we can call the monetary theory of production, or MCM prime that Anwar talked about the other day, or Veblen's theory of business enterprise. So that is the view that in a capitalist economy, the purpose of production is to end up with more money than it started with. So profit drives the system, as Anwar was saying. Second, the institutionalist approach emphasizes money as an institution. In fact, probably the most important institution in a capitalist economy. And it's all bound up with power, power relations. Third, post-Keynesians like to talk about the relation of money and uncertainty. Keynes said, holding money quells the disquietude. There's this focus on liquidity preference, writing contracts in money terms to keep your options open to deal with the uncertainty about the future. Chartalists, maybe that's new for some people. It's based on the work of Knapp and Innes, who argue that what we have is a state money, and our money is all tied up with sovereignty of the state. Functional finance, which was the title Rania gave to the talk, but again, I said I wanted to be broader than that. And that also looks at the relationship of the state and its spending to money. So anyway, all together, these things are what I mean when I say modern money. I think it integrates all of the heterodox approaches to money. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be able to go into all of that now. So what I'm going to try to do tonight is first talk about what is money, why is it accepted, what's the relation of the state to its money, what is fiscal policy, what is monetary policy, and how does a sovereign currency create policy space to do, well, we hope, to use policy to achieve the public purpose. Okay, so first, what is money? Are these money? The top one is a stone 500,000 years old. It has human-made scratches dug up by archaeologists. What is it? Okay, below that, 50,000 years old. These are bones scratched much more complexly by humans. What is it? What are these? On the right-hand side, these are the clay Shubati tablets. We actually can read these, so we know that they are all about debt. The left-hand side, these are wooden tally sticks. This is what most people paid taxes to the crown using, and what most crown spending was financed by. Okay. Now, finally, you see something that virtually everybody would say, this is money. Okay, Roman coins, Confederate paper notes, United States in the South, and finally the euros. Okay, are those money? Well, no, none of those are money. Money is not something we're going to dig up out of the ground. Money is not even the pieces of paper that we all recognize now. Money is not a thing. Money is a social unit of account. And at least today, all of those social units of account are state monies. Keynes argued that the state money has existed. In fact, all monies, he said, have been state monies for the last 4,000 years at least. Now, maybe that's debatable, but it's not debatable at all that today's monies are state units of account, the dollar in the United States, the euro in Euroland. What I showed you might be money things, okay? That is, things denominated in money. They're denominated in money, but they are not money. And these money things are actually all IOUs. They're IOUs denominated in the state's money of account. Now, Minsky always said anyone can create money, and what he meant in my terminology is anyone can create a money thing. That is, you can write an IOU denominated in some state's unit of account. Whether you can get it accepted, he said, is another matter. Okay, anyone can create it, but can you get it accepted? what backs up our money? Now, I know none of you are going to say gold, but when I ask freshman students, a lot of them still think, oh, gold. Fort Knox, we've got gold that backs it up. Then I have them take out a note, and what they find on the U.S. dollars, it says, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Canadian dollar, this note is legal tender. Australian dollar, the Australian note is legal tender. The U.K. pound, interesting, doesn't say that at all. It says, it's the Queen, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £5. This was a £5 note. What does that mean? It means if you take the £5 note down to the Treasury, they'll give you another £5 note. Okay? What backs it up? Legal tender law? No. Gold? No. The promise that you can get another $5 note. What is it? Many people call these things fiat money. That is, the state announces it will have this value. Okay? With apparently nothing backing it up. Here's Alan. When you pull away the cape, what's there? It's a piece of paper. Okay? Apparently. So let me present to you the alternative view. It's not gold. It's not legal tender. It's not a government fiat. There actually is a very real thing that backs up our money. The use of the currency and value of the money are based on the power of the issuing authority. Obviously not on intrinsic value, because there's no intrinsic value at all in paper notes. But I would argue that this is true even in the case of gold coins. Okay? Even in the case of what many people call commodity money, supposedly had an intrinsic value. I believe that that view is false, always has been false. That is not what gave the money things value. The state played a central role in the evolution of money. I don't need to go into that. But, of course, orthodoxy has a completely different story. And all of you who had a principles and economics course learned about Robinson Crusoe and Friday, and they used seashells and all that. The whole story doesn't require a state at all. For them, the state comes in at the very end, illegitimately imposes itself on the money that already existed. I believe that history and also logic shows that it could not have been that way. But I won't go into that. What we almost always observe is one nation, one currency. And until euro, we could say all the exceptions are very, very minor cases. Euroland is a huge exception to this. Okay, Euroland is not a sovereign currency. The euro is not a sovereign currency. In the sense that no individual state in Euroland has sovereign power, okay? Now, I probably won't have time to talk about Euroland, but I can in Q&A if anyone's interested. These separate currencies are not a coincidence. Why, when the Soviet Union broke up, did every new country adopt its own new currency? It's not a coincidence. It's tied up with sovereignty. It's tied up with power. So the argument that I'm going to make is it's not that there's nothing standing behind these currencies. It's not fiat. It's the tax system. It's the tax system that stands behind the currencies. So in shorthand, I say taxes drive money. Now, let me just say that taxes drive money certainly is an explanation of the way it is today. People say, well, In Northern Africa, there's some countries that people claim don't impose taxes. If we go farther back in time, before 1840s, most revenue, even in a developed country like Britain, were in the form of fines and fees, not taxes. But that's fine. Really, to make it more general, we would say obligations drive the currency. It doesn't matter whether the state imposes on you a tax or a fine that you have to pay or a fee that you must pay. Okay? They all amount to the same thing. The state imposes an obligation. It chooses a unit of account in which to measure that obligation. You must pay $5. Okay? What's the dollar? It's the unit of account used to measure the obligation. And then finally, the state names what you can deliver to pay off your obligation. That is the money thing. The money thing then is what is delivered to eliminate the obligation the state has put on you. Taxes drive money. So now let's go back to the questions and see why the correct answer was false to each one of those. Just like a household, the government has to finance its spending. Well, unlike a household, the government is the issuer of its own currency. Now, currency, think of it broadly as high-powered money. High-powered money is the paper notes, the coins, and bank reserves. That's what we mean by high-powered money. The state is the issuer of all of those things. Households cannot issue those things. Okay, if you know anybody who's printing up dollar bills in their basement, you know that they're in potentially big trouble. You're not allowed to do that. But the state issues the currency. It is an issuer. You are a user. There's a huge difference between a household and a state. The state actually has to spend before it can collect any tax revenue. You have to have the thing issued by the state before you can pay it to the state. Okay? Government spending is constrained only by what is offered for sale in terms of the state's own currency. If there's anything for sale at all, the state can always buy it by issuing currency. Again, broadly defined, including bank reserves. Because most spending today, the state doesn't actually use coins or notes to buy it. It credits bank accounts. I'll come back to that in a second. All other constraints are self-imposed. That doesn't mean that it's a bad idea to self-impose them. You don't want your state to buy everything that's for sale, right? You want some things to be left for households and firms to buy. So the self-imposed constraints can be a very good thing. But there is no financial constraint on state spending. Second, the role of taxes is to provide finance for government spending. Well, obviously, that can't be true if the state has to spend before you can pay your taxes. Simply as a matter of logic, it can't be true. So what is the purpose of taxes? It's not to pay for the state's spending. The taxes are what create the sellers of real goods and services that are purchased by the government. Why is anyone willing to offer to sell things to the state? Because ultimately, at least from inception, you have to pay a tax in the state's money thing, and the only way to get that money thing is to sell to the state, beg the state to give it to you, or steal it from someone else. From the perspective of the government, the purpose of the monetary system is to transfer real goods and services from the private to the public domain. So we can think of it from the state's point of view, the purpose of the whole monetary system is a more efficient method of moving part of the resources to the state, hopefully to be used in the public interest, but obviously not always. Okay, so taxes drive money again. They don't finance government spending. The federal government borrows money from the private sector to finance the budget deficit that allows it to avoid just printing up money. Okay, first, the government actually does not, and in a very significant way, cannot borrow from the private sector. The issuer of the currency can't borrow back its own currency. I don't know if you've ever written an IOU to your neighbor. You're going to borrow some sugar. Okay? When you get the IOU back, what do you do with it? You take the sugar back to the neighbor. Neighbor gives you the IOU. What do you do with it? Do you go out and spend it? Okay. No. You tear it up and throw it away. Effectively, that is what the state does with the proceeds from sales of government bonds. It is actually not a borrowing operation. It's receiving back its own currency. Okay? Obviously, it doesn't need to do it. It also technically can't do it. It just results in a debit to to a bank account. I'll get to that. Typically, the government does not print money, so let's see how money actually enters the economy. Commercial banks keep reserve accounts at the central bank to facilitate clearing. They've got to clear with each other, but from this perspective, more importantly, they have to clear with the state itself. The government spends by simultaneously crediting the bank deposit of the firm or household that sells something to the state or of a Social Security recipient. And at the same time, it credits the reserves of that person's or that firm's bank. So there's a simultaneous credit to the bank's reserves and to the bank's deposits. Okay, and that is how the state spends. So if anyone ever asks you, you know, how do governments spend? They credit bank accounts. That's how they spend. They credit both the deposit side and the reserve side. When the government taxes, it just reverses that. It debits the bank deposit of the taxpayer and debits their bank's reserves. Where do the tax receipts go? They disappear. That's where they go. That's why I say they can't be spent. Technically, they can't be spent because it's just a debit to a bank account. That's all a tax payment is. If you can watch your bank account online when you pay your taxes, you can watch the money disappear from your account. Where did it go? It disappeared. It is now gone. Okay? If the government spends more than it taxes, it must be net crediting bank accounts. It is net crediting the deposits and net crediting the reserves. That's what a budget deficit is. It's a net credit. If the government ran a budget surplus, it's a net debit. That's all it is. Government isn't accumulating anything that it can spend in the future. It's just a net debit. That's all it is. Now, when the government is spending more than it is taxing, it's net crediting reserves. This is probably going to lead to excess reserves in the banking system, more reserves than they want or are required to hold. If you just think about it for a second, if the U.S. government runs a $500 billion deficit over the course of a year, which would be a small deficit now, but $500 billion, it will have net credited bank reserves by $500 billion. There is no way that banks will want an extra $500 billion of reserves over the course of a year. Okay, it's far too much. So what do? They offer it in the overnight lending market called the Fed funds market in the United States. So what does that do? It puts immediate downward pressure on the overnight interest rate, which is the Fed funds rate. The excess reserves push the overnight interest rate down. So what has to happen? The central bank, which is the Fed, and the Treasury have to drain those excess reserves out of the banking system. How do they do it? They sell bonds. The Treasury sells bonds in the new issue market. The Fed sells bonds in the open market. The sale of those bonds allows banks to substitute holding a bond that earns interest versus holding reserves, which until a year ago paid zero. Now reserves pay a little bit of interest. Still, banks don't want to hold, well, in normal times, don't want to hold excess reserves. They'd rather hold a higher earning asset. So what happens is that the budget deficits lead to excess reserves that are drained by bond sales. So what is the effect of the bond sales? It is not a borrowing operation. It's a reserve draining operation. Whether the bonds are sold by the Fed or the Treasury, they have exactly the same impact on the banking system, and that impact is to remove excess reserves so that the interest rate doesn't go to zero. What happens if you don't drain the reserves, you don't sell the bonds? The interest rate goes to zero. Did anyone notice that Japan had an essentially zero interest rate when they had the biggest budget deficits in the world for a dozen years? It's because they didn't sell enough bonds to drain all the excess reserves. Okay? Now, I wrote here in the bottom in capitals. A lot of people say, oh, well, that's a proposal. It would cause hyperinflation if the government ever operated that way. This is not a proposal. This is the way it actually is done. Okay? All I am doing is describing the way that it actually works. It's not a proposal. Will this cause hyperinflation? Japan had deflation while they were doing this. Okay? So obviously, no, it doesn't cause hyperinflation. It's just a description. You might have inflation, you might have deflation while you're operating this way. Question four, running budget surpluses takes pressure off interest rates. Well, actually, of course, it has to be exactly the opposite. Budget deficits push interest rates down. Budget surpluses push interest rates up. Why? Because a budget surplus means you're draining reserves. Banks will eventually be short reserves. Okay? They will bid up the Fed funds rate trying to get reserves. It can only be relieved by an injection of reserves. So actually, it's the exact opposite of what you were always taught in economics, the whole idea of crowding out. Has it exactly wrong. Budget surpluses push interest rates up. Budget deficits push interest rates down. Yeah, I won't go into the last point because it could take some time. We don't really need the bond sales at all. We can just pay the overnight interest rate target on reserves as Canada does, and then you're always able to hit your reserves without using bond sales or purchases at all. Question five, persistent budget deficits will lead to higher taxes and inflation later on. Well, first, clearly, it would be inflationary if you keep pushing up government spending, keep pushing up budget deficits beyond the point of full employment. So deficits can be too big, not in the sense that you can't finance the government spending, but in the sense that it can be inflationary. But are budget deficits automatically inflationary? Of course not. Again, Japan is a good example. Now, virtually the whole developed world is moving into budget deficits with deflationary pressures. So obviously there's not a close link between deficits and inflation. But in any case, there is no need for taxes to be higher in the future because we're running budget deficits now. You never need to pay down the government debt in the first place. Does anyone know? There actually was only 1 year in which the United States government was not in debt. Does anyone know when it was? The last time we paid down all the government debt. It was 1837, and we went into a depression, and we never got rid of our debt again. Okay? There actually have only been seven times when we reduced the outstanding stock of government debt. Six of those were followed by our six depressions. The seventh was the Clinton years, and now we're feeling the results of that. So maybe it will be a perfect 7 for 7. Anyway, you don't have to repay the debt. What you have to do is pay the interest on the debt. And how does the government pay interest on debt? Exactly the same way it makes any other payment. It credits a bank account. There is no financial constraint on the government's ability to make interest payments as they come due. So, no, there is no reason why budget deficits now lead to higher taxes later. Question six, running a surplus now will make it easier to take care of the baby boomers in the future. Okay, the ability of the government to provide services in the future is in no way affected by the current or past budget outcome, whether surplus or deficit. The government, again, can always make payments as they come due. The government can always make Social Security payments to the retired baby boomers in the year 2030 as those payments come due by crediting bank accounts. Budget surpluses today, or budget deficits today, either one, in no way impact the government's ability to do that in the future. So there is no link across time. in the way that Orthodoxy believes. What is the constraint on 2030 or 2050? How much real production there is. That is the constraint. Will there be stuff for sale? Okay. If there is, baby boomers will have a good retirement. If there isn't, they're not going to have a good retirement. It has nothing to do with finance. It has everything to do with real production. Okay, those are the six questions. Now let me go into just a little bit of detail on monetary policy and fiscal policy. Okay, private banks create deposits when they make loans. This is the endogenous money story that is pretty familiar now. They set their interest rates relative to the overnight target rate set by the central bank. There's a markup to get to the loan rate, a markdown to get to the deposit rate. There has to be a spread between the rate they pay on deposits and the rate they charge on loans. And that spread is partly determined by competition with other banks and also with the non-bank or the shadow bank part of the financial system. So there is some relativity to the central bank's overnight interest rate target. Banks clear accounts using reserves. They clear with other banks and they clear with the government. If they're short, the central bank lends reserves to them at, in the case of the United States, the discount rate. The central bank cannot control the quantity of reserves it lends. It always accommodates the demand for reserves. There are lots of reasons for this, but the basic reason is that the purpose of central banks, and in fact the explicit reason why the Fed was created, is to ensure that checks clear at par. You don't want one bank's checks to be worth only 80 cents on the dollar and another bank's checks to be worth a dollar. So to ensure par clearing, the central bank must provide reserves to allow the payment system to function. So the central bank has no control over the quantity of reserves or the quantity of money things that are created by the private banking system. It sets the overnight rate, and then it supplies reserves on demand. Now note that most of what we call our money supply is privately created. That is, banking deposits, demand deposits, savings deposits, M1, M2, M3. The majority of that stuff is created by the private banking system. But the private banking system cannot create any net wealth because all of the inside wealth nets to zero. The only source of net financial wealth is the government. The government can create net financial wealth, but the private sector cannot. Conclusions about monetary policy, because there's been lots of confusion, partly because Milton Friedman in the last 30 years really dominated thinking about monetary policy. Then we got the new monetary consensus. We've got inflation targeting. There's all sorts of misunderstanding out there. What is it really all about? Central bank can't control the money supply. Okay, it doesn't really print money. It doesn't provide the raw material from which private banks are able to produce our money supply. In other words, it's not the case that the central bank supplies reserves and then banks use a deposit multiplier to expand the money supply. It's actually got to be the reverse. The private banks, okay, increase the money supply, and then the central bank simply accommodates by providing the reserves that they need. Central bank sets the overnight rate target. It then hits that within its own band of discretion. It allows it the Fed funds rate, in the case of the United States, to fluctuate around its target. And then it adds or drains reserves as necessary to keep the fluctuation within the desired band. It always accommodates bank demand for reserves. It always cooperates with the Treasury's operations to ensure, first, that the Treasury's checks never bounce. That is, the Treasury never writes a check that someone deposits in their bank And then the Fed says, oh, sorry, the Treasury doesn't have a big enough deposit at the central bank. We're going to have to bounce that check. That never happens, and if the Fed ever did that, it would be called in before Congress, and the instructions would be rewritten. And second, the taxpayer checks don't bounce. If you have money in your deposit account, whether your bank has reserves or not, your check is going to clear. The central bank will always provide the reserves that are necessary so that your check can clear. Okay, fiscal policy. Taxation doesn't raise money, it destroys it. It's just a net debit to the banking system. Issuing government debt doesn't raise money, it just destroys it. The banks have a debit to their reserves and a credit to their bond holdings. Okay, it's just destroying money. Budget deficits drive interest rates down. As I already explained, budget deficits create private sector wealth. As I said, the private sector cannot create financial wealth. Only the government can create net wealth in the private sector. They do that by running budget deficits, which lead to net credits to your bank accounts. And then if that leads to excess reserves, it sells bonds. So it's the private sector that decides, would we rather have high-powered money or government bonds? We make that decision, okay, the form in which we hold our net wealth, but the government is the creator of our net financial wealth. And finally, budget surpluses destroy private sector financial wealth, and that is why budget surpluses, in the case of the United States, have always been followed by a depression, at least by a downturn. This time, maybe it's going to turn out to be another depression. Only the government can create net financial wealth. Only the government can spend without first obtaining finance. Only the government has a monopoly over money issue. Only the government can offer an infinite supply of jobs. So I know that the people have this question, why do you guys who are supporting ELR always want to get back to this stuff? The reason why is because if you don't have a sovereign government, the issuer of the currency, you don't have the possibility of offering the open-ended commitment to hire anybody who wants to work. Only the issuer of the currency can do this. No private firm can do it. Okay. First, they don't want to because they're in business to make profit. But even if they're willing to give up profit, they still face a financial constraint. Only the national government, the issuer of the currency, faces no financial constraint. So only the government can ensure continuous full employment. So the conclusion, and I think Rania said something like this, is the government must be responsible because it's the only entity that can do it. It's the government's job to get us to full employment. Nobody else can do it. Okay, finally, a sovereign currency provides the policy space that you need. If you have a currency union, a pegged currency, a gold standard, the first priority policy has to be to keep your exchange rate fixed. That has to be the first goal of policy. Now, you still may have some fiscal policy space, some monetary policy space. It will depend on your own individual situation. China can peg their currency. Okay. And they still have a lot of domestic policy space. We see that right now. They're stimulating their economy, even though the whole world economy is going to hell, right? They can do it because they have a big enough dollar reserve to fend off any speculators. They have a plausible reserve to hold their exchange rate. There are a few other countries in that really nice situation. Most other countries do not have and don't have the capability of gaining a big enough reserve to fend off the speculators. So they have to focus policy on keeping that exchange rate constant. Okay? With a sovereign currency and a flexible exchange rate, you have greater fiscal and monetary policy space. Now, of course, it's always going to be limited, not by finance, but for one thing, based on the capacity of your economy to produce. Okay? The government can't buy things that aren't for sale. And it also can't withdraw everything from the private sector. because the private sector would disappear and the productive capacity would probably decline. So there always are constraints, but they're not financial constraints. Now, when I'm saying this, I already said this this afternoon, I'm not necessarily advocating that every country adopt this sovereign currency and just completely float their exchange rate and let the markets do whatever they want to do to the exchange rate. Okay, you can still have what Keynes called a managed exchange rate. So you need to have a flexible exchange rate, but you don't have to have a completely market-determined exchange rate. To the degree that you can ignore the exchange rate, you'll have greater fiscal and monetary policy space for other domestic policy. The policy space then gives you the power to operate in the public interest. Again, governments obviously don't always operate in the public interest. You know, that's what democracy is all about, trying to force them to operate in the public interest. But then it can give you the power to pursue the kinds of policies that we might like, which is full employment with price stability, and I believe you do that with the employer of last resort or job guarantee, the space to pursue gender equality, pursue development and growth, and whatever other agenda that we want to impose on government. If you don't have the sovereign currency, it becomes a lot more difficult to do those things. Okay, I'll stop. See if there are any questions. Whoops, I forgot my pen and pencil.
First of all, thanks a lot for really such a nice and light-hearted, fun presentation. I cannot claim that I understood everything that you just said, but I'm thinking about your conclusions. You said if budget deficit creates private wealth, right? And you know, if I know anything about markets and private sector, I know that they really do pursue their self-interest. So I'm wondering, why don't they then? Why are they so, you know, the private sector is not able to figure this out? That's my first question. Second question is about the government deficit, the budget deficit and the interest rates, downward pressure on interest rates. Is this supported by empirical evidence?
Should I do them individually? I don't have a very good memory. Okay, I would just restate it slightly. The private sector pursues its perceived self-interest, and that's not the same thing as pursuing its self-interest. So there's a perception, there could be a perception problem, not understanding the way the system works. Now, I don't think that that explains all the behavior. I do think that a good part of the policymakers people on Wall Street do understand what I'm talking about. And I've talked to them. I know they understand it. I know the people who work in money markets, I can say, oh, bond sale is not a borrowing operation, it's a reserve drain. They say, yeah, we know that. They know it immediately. Okay, but it's politically useful to make various kinds of arguments, right? So even if you do completely understand this, then you can use the argument about excessive government spending, budget deficits, if you don't like social spending. And I think that that explains a big part of why don't we get some of the preferred progressive policies when Obama comes into office. Well, it may not be in the individual self-interest of the person making the argument. Just saying that the budget deficits are going to increase net wealth in the private sector doesn't say I'm going to get it. Okay, so what would I prefer? I want the government to spend on me, okay, not on you guys, sure, it's going to increase private sector net wealth, but I want the government to spend on me, not you. And the, oh, sorry, what was the second? Oh, empirical? Sure. Okay, empirically, if we think of, when did the U.S. run its biggest budget deficits? World War II. What was the interest rate? 0.375%. The budget deficit was 25% of GDP, government spending was 50% of GDP, and the interest rate was 0.375%. Japan. Biggest budget deficits outside of World War II of any developed country in the history of the world, interest rate was zero. Okay? So there's empirical evidence. But I think, no, there's not contrary empirical evidence. The point is that the central bank can choose any interest rate target it wants, and it may react against budget deficits by raising its target. Okay? So if you want to have 100% interest rate, you can have 100% interest rate whether there's a budget surplus or a budget deficit. In the United States, the Fed actually was raising its interest rate target when Clinton ran a budget surplus, reacting in a very strange way, you know, according to their own ideology and their theory of the way the economy works. But that is what they did. The point is, the interest rate is determined by the central bank. It can be going up when you have a budget deficit. It can be going down when you have a budget deficit, but it's determined by the central bank.
Do you have any
example from the European Council? Okay. I also did not understand everything that you said, but I know that I have to read a lot more, and I keep promising myself that I will read your book, and I still have not done it. So I am a very guilty person in this respect. But what you are describing tracks to the T the U.S. situation, mm-hmm. for sure. What you were saying, that at times of, you know, you have budget surpluses, interest rates were being increased by the central bank. And likewise now with the deficits that we have, et cetera. Okay, so essentially the story that you're saying tracks the U.S. perfectly. But this is not the experience in many developing countries. There are several statements, actually, that you made that both earlier and now that do not reflect the reality. Not reflecting the reality, I do not doubt that it is hard actually to differentiate the cause and the effect of it. So which is first and which is second, essentially, because you can have two things happening at the same time, but you don't know if it is causing it. So the crowding out has been criticized from many different perspectives. The point is that for, to go to the employment of last resort bit, right, you do not have actually sovereign states. So how do you do these programs? I mean, you have both the IMF breathing down your neck, and whatever reserves you have to have them there to defend your currency. If I am in Greece right now, I have no monetary policy, no fiscal policy. I have nothing for nothing. So how do I do this? Well, that's my question.
That was the last 5 minutes of the ELR. So if you don't have a sovereign currency, then if you're China, you can still offer the open-ended commitment, at least for the foreseeable future. But most countries cannot do this. That's why you have to have a different design. You implement slowly. You have it as part of a package for development so that you can eventually get off your exchange rate peg, so that you can eventually float your currency. You can still have job creation programs, but they're going to have to be limited. You have to always worry about the exchange rate. Exactly. That's exactly correct.
The same thing about the government spending on anything.
Well, okay, look. If you have dollarized and you're not the United States, and if you have dollarized on the U.S. dollar, then you've got to get the U.S. dollar in order to spend. That is why Argentina had its crisis. It dollarized. And eventually, even though its budget deficit was only 3% of GDP when it went into a crisis, 3% of GDP, it would even have been able to meet all the Maastricht criteria, and it had a crisis. Why? Because it had the dollar. So, of course, you're going to be constrained. But it just about the, do developing nations operate this way? If they have their own currency, yes, they do operate this way. Government spends by crediting bank accounts, and the central bank sets an interest rate target. That is the way they do it. Now, if you've dollarized, you don't set your interest rate. The U.S. sets the dollar interest rate, and then markets add a risk premium to you. So you've completely lost control. You've given up any control of your domestic interest rate.
One thing I could not understand clearly, that is why if budget deficit increases, and if it is financed by borrowing, why the interest rate would go down?
Okay.
That is not clear to me.
Okay.
And I have two more questions. One is, if there is a change in foreign exchange reserve in the context of an open economy, does anything change in your framework? Thirdly, what is an exchange rate? What is the way you have defined money, what would be the exchange rate? What is the definition of an exchange rate?
Okay. The
I'm gonna come around, but I have a mic problem recently.
Oh, I see. I'll help with the mic. I'll help with the mic.
I have a problem with this exchange rate management. In Uzbekistan, it's a former Soviet country, government practices heavily managed float exchange rate regime. And over the last 5 years, when the government applied expansionary fiscal policy, what happened is the official rate stayed at the managed rate, but there was a parallel market was created, which reflected the real exchange rate, which was to a certain level was depreciated from the official. How would you explain that?
Watch out! I've got it.
It's left off.
I have a difficulty in understanding the framework you have presented, especially because I'm working very close to the financial markets. And as far as I'm, very faced with the daily usual stuff in the financial markets, apart not the central bank, it is the financial markets who dictate the interest rates, in fact. Especially when the country is open, it is the private investors, foreign private investors, who are in the country, which is dictating the interest rates. So it's a little bit hard for me to understand that central bank is setting the interest rate, if he can set it's 100%. No, it's not. When they decide to go out, the interest rate goes up to 30%. When they decide to come in, the interest rate comes down to 12%. So it's a little bit confusing for me. And also, we have to maybe differentiate between the private investors, local private domain, and the external private domain, because if government budget deficit is something, as Gül said, is creating private wealth, then why IMF is insisting on cutting budget deficits and cutting throats of the governments to save and create surpluses. That's also hard for me to understand in your within this context.
Do you want to take those, Randy?
Okay. So sovereign governments don't borrow. It's not one of the alternatives. They spend in only one way. They credit bank accounts. Why do they sell bonds? It's not a borrowing operation. It's to drain excess reserves from the banking system. Reserves that they created when they spent. So if you think about the bank balance sheet, if you sell an aircraft carrier to the government, they credit your bank account by the amount of the sale, and they credit your bank's reserves by the amount of the sale. So they just created $1 billion of reserves, okay? Your bank doesn't want $1 billion in reserves. They offer them in the overnight market. That pushes the overnight interest rate below the target. So the immediately, the central bank will start selling bonds to drain it. Now, central banks don't issue the bonds. They have to sell the bonds they actually have on the shelf, okay? They're going to run out of bonds really quickly. So what they do is they notify the Treasury. In the United States, the New York Fed talks to the Treasury every morning, and they plan how many bonds the Treasury is going to sell to drain reserves, and then the central bank will pick up the slop, okay? So they got to coordinate their operations to make sure that they sell, the Treasury sells enough bonds that the central bank is not going to run out of bonds trying to drain the extra excess reserves out of the system. So the purpose of bond sales is to drain reserves. It's not a borrowing operation, okay? So that, and that also gets to the point of the interest rate. Now, who sets that overnight interest rate? Can the market set it? No, the market cannot set this interest rate. It has to be set by the central bank because budget deficits create excess reserves. What the market will do with those excess reserves is drive the interest rate to zero. The interest rate that the market will determine must be zero if there are any excess reserves in the banking system. The reason is because the market cannot get rid of reserves. Only the government can get rid of them. The market can lend them to another bank, okay, but they can't get rid of them. It's like a hot potato. It ends up in another bank. The only way to get rid of them is a bond sale by the government. So either the central bank or the Treasury has to sell bonds. How many will they sell? They sell enough to get the interest rate back to the central bank's target. The market will not get it back there. The central bank has to do it. Now, I am only talking about the overnight policy interest rate. The policy interest rate is set by the central bank. In most countries, the central bank just targets one. Now, in theory, the central bank could have an overnight interest rate, a 30-day interest rate, a 6-month interest rate, a 1-year interest rate, a 10-year interest rate, and they can offer deposit accounts at the central bank with an interest rate for each one of these terms. Okay, and in fact, there is a proposal in the United States for the Fed to start doing this. And it probably will start offering term deposits in order to try to peg some of the interest rates. The problem is that, of course, they've gotten the overnight interest rate down to about zero, but they haven't been able to get longer-term interest rates down. So part of their strategy is going to be to start offering interest rate on other kinds of maturities to try to manipulate those. Whether it will work, I don't know. But my point is the other interest rates are market-determined, okay, but we shouldn't think of just, you know, nice competitive markets. It's collusion among the banks. It's the people who manage LIBOR, a bunch of men in ties and white shirts that sit down and set the LIBOR interest rate, okay? But we can call that the market. sets the other interest rates, but the overnight policy rate is set by the central bank. Someone asked, what about countries other than the U.S.? Yeah, people have done exactly the analysis that I just gave you for Brazil, for Canada, for Australia. It is all done exactly the same way that I just described in those countries. And you can do it for your own country. You can find out, okay, how does the central bank coordinate with the Treasury to allow the central bank to hit its overnight interest rate target? And you will find that they've developed procedures probably a little bit different from the U.S.'s, but they have developed procedures to allow the central bank to hit its target interest rate. Can markets influence the overnight interest rate target? Yes, they can. How do they do it? Okay. They've got connections with the central bankers, and they say, we're worried about inflation. We think you better raise the interest rate. And so the central bank might react to that. Okay. But that is the way that the market can influence the overnight rate target. They tell the central bank, we don't like the target you have. We want you to choose a different one. Okay. Expansionary policy effects on the exchange rate. Expansionary policy might affect the exchange rate. I was talking about the interest rate. Budget deficits will tend to push the interest rate down. Budget deficits could conceivably tend to push your exchange rate down. They could. But again, as I said before, we don't really have any good models of what determines exchange rates, and you can find plenty of examples where the exchange rate improves as the budget deficit gets worse. Okay, so it's not a theoretical link, and not a necessarily an empirical link. So the fiscal policy can impact the exchange rate. I think I sort of got all of them, but my definition of exchange rate is the same. This is just a description of the way things work. Yes, there's still a dollar pound exchange rate, a dollar euro exchange rate. Fine.
Well, I come from Ecuador, and in the 2000 years, we changed to the dollarization.
Yeah.
And all the macroeconomic indicators were very well, and they say because it was the dollarization. But until the 2004, we have a lot of money coming from the other countries, more of from the United States and Spain, because we have many migrants in these places, and also we have money coming from to build the oleoduct to transport petroleum from the jungle to the port. Now, after the crisis, we have a very strong problems. We don't have money coming from our immigrants. They are more of them that are coming inside the country, and there is no good prices for the community for the commodities. And now we have a big problem because to change the money is a very big decision. The president doesn't want to do it because it's probably the population can put him out of the country. But also they are now focusing in incomes from the other minerals. Now they are thinking to take money from the gold and from other minerals. And that is becoming a very big problem inside the country, because we are really worried about what's going to happen with our environment. But by the way, the government say that they don't have other option. That is the only option that they have. And that is the way that we are. And we asked about what could be the other opportunity to have incomes.
Thank you very much. That's very generous intervention. I'm going to only take 4 minutes. and as always, a very interesting discussion. I guess a number of us have similar kinds of thoughts, and one of the things that maybe others are also saying, but certainly I am asking and wondering about, is that this is a good description of the hegemon of the world economy. And this is a little bit contested hegemon right now, but it's still, I would say, in a hegemonic position. And also the issue of the vehicle currency in the world economy. So, and that puts the United States in a very, 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 very different position than everybody else. So the U.S., you know, the Chinese can be holding the assets, everybody else can be holding the assets, but that is not the same for every other country. And you may call that difference the sovereign risk, but this risk can be so high that it can choke all investment, all domestic investment. And in fact, Turkey is a very typical case of this. So I think this is why a lot of us are wondering whether we should sort of keep the analysis of the hegemon of the world economy or take it as a special case and see the differences between the hegemon and the non-hegemonic countries. And non-hegemonic countries, there's also a lot of variation across them. So, I mean, Brazil also might be very, very different from a country in another country in continent X, Y, and so on. So it's not that developing countries also have similar structures or institutional structures. So that may be true for the case of Brazil, but I think we need to be careful before we generalize because of the special position of the U.S. In the world economy. And the second question, and a lot of people are asking that kind of question, is then what happens with capital account liberalization versus, you know, capital controls. And that's a very, very important dividing line. I mean, I know you talked about exchange rate and flexible exchange rates and so on, but really the issue is also about capital account liberalization, which is where some of these questions are coming from. I think I've finished my 5 minutes.
Okay. Oh, am I ready? Okay. Dollarization. No, I'm not ready. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, this is related. I think you are very acute in describing how money is of and between human minds. I mean, that's absolutely true. But therefore, expectations are critical. So in a sense, what everybody is asking is really, where is expectations in this description? And once you bring in expectations, then it's not even just, I mean, the hegemon is the hegemon because everybody expects. I mean, in other words, it is the power of the U.S. which gives it that the U.S. money that power. But therefore, expectations affect everything. And in fact, if people expect the budget deficit to create inflation, it will create inflation. And similarly, if in certain situations markets expect a certain thing, those expectations will become self-fulfilling. And I think if you're talking about money, I mean, liquidity preference is all about expectations. You have to bring that in, and I'm not seeing that in this.
Okay, now are we ready? Dollarization, it seems like a good strategy when you've got high inflation like Argentina had. The problem is, as you're implying, it's very hard to get off it. So it can be very effective at fighting inflation and helping to stabilize the economy, helping expectations. But then the problem is that ultimately it's going to constrain your fiscal and monetary policy space so that when you've got a crisis, how are you going to get out of it? You can't. You have to export your way out. You have to have something to sell to get dollars. And that was the problem faced by Argentina. Of course, the way they resolved it was they defaulted, they got off the dollar, they went back to their own currency. They had a crisis, but they recovered. So maybe that's not what you want to hear, because it's going to be painful to get off. The hegemon, of course, the U.S. Has military power, economic power, and some extra advantages because the rest of the world is using the dollar. But all the stuff I'm describing here applies to any country with a sovereign currency. Okay? Now, do we have additional advantages to that? Yes. We can run trade deficits much bigger and much more permanent probably than any other country in the world. Does that give us an advantage? Yes, because a trade deficit means net benefits. We don't have to work as hard to export stuff in order to get the rest of the world's output. But all of this stuff is just accounting, and the same accounting applies to any sovereign nation. The capital controls could be a very good thing and even a necessary thing for countries that want to float their currency but are worried about the possible impacts on exchange rates if speculators or just world events turn against them. So I'm not opposed to capital controls. In fact, they might be a necessary requirement for many countries in the world. I don't think they're a requirement for the developed world, but for developing nations, they might be. Expectations, of course, they're important. They're a big part of the post-Keynesian story about why people want to use money and monetary contracts. And yes, when expectations turn down, it gets a lot harder to get out of a recession, a financial crisis, as we're discovering now. However, I think that the expectations of inflation or the expectations of continued depression can pretty easily be overcome by the real world. And government can use its policy to change the real outcomes, and the expectations will change. In other words, expectations around the United States and the world right now are very depressed. Can we change those? Yes, we can. We use fiscal policy. We use employer of last resort. We get to full employment. Those expectations are going to turn around. Expectations of inflation will be defeated by lower inflation. And we can use monetary and fiscal policy, mostly fiscal policy, to get lower inflation. Expectations are important. People won't continue to think to expect things that are not occurring, though. The government... But the government is the external source. But eventually those things are resolved, aren't they? Sometimes better. Yeah, right? But the expectations do turn around, right? And if the government operated in a better manner, they could resolve the crisis quicker. Look, no, the accounting that I'm presenting to you obviously does not apply to countries that don't have their own currency. Does that mean everything is hopeless? Probably not. Okay, you have to design programs. If you're going to stay under the control of the franc, you have to design programs that aren't going to endanger your exchange rate. Does that limit your policy space? Yes, it does.
Okay. Thanks. I think my right is leaving.